Good morning. I'm Pat Thurston. We have a guest who's joining us in this half hour of the program, Karen Chapman. She's an independent investigative environmental journalist, and she recently wrote an article that appeared on the website whowhatwhy.com. This is one of the websites that I go to quite regularly, and if you haven't been there, you're really going to like it. It's an investigative journalistic website. It's excellent. They are fearless. You'll find articles here that you are not going to find elsewhere. But going back to Karen's piece, it's headlined Fukushima Update: Why We Should Still Be Worried. And she joins us now on the Pat Thurston program. Karen Chapman, She went away, Lynn. Can you get her back? Karen? No, she's away. Okay, we're going to get her back here because she wrote this piece concerning what's going on. Okay, she's back. Karen, are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us this morning. It's so great to have you on the program.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, you betcha. So the earthquake and the tsunami, when it first struck Japan, really the world sat up and took notice, at least for a week. You know, we seemed to care what was going on. We paid attention to the footage of the nuclear plants. And I think most people were sort of waiting for a mushroom cloud. And when that failed to materialize, people went home. And I guess they figured that everything was under control and that disaster was averted. But the truth is, there were multiple meltdowns. Is that right?
There were three meltdowns, yes.
And were they were they total meltdowns?
Yes. They were.
And what is that? What exactly does that mean? Because when we think of meltdown, we also think of the China syndrome.
Right. I think the thing with nuclear power is that what we're learning is that accidents can happen in many different ways. And with Chernobyl, for example, there was an explosion. So a lot of the reactor material went up into the air and then was dispersed basically all over the northern hemisphere, contaminating 40% of Europe pretty severely. And but it did actually go throughout the northern hemisphere. The accidents at Fukushima were different because in this case, what happened was the water, the 50-foot wall of water from the tsunami basically swamped the plants and disabled their ability to keep the reactors cool. And so that's part of the big problem with nuclear power, not the only problem, certainly, but, you know, one of the big ones, is that if you don't keep all of this very, very hot material cool, thermally cool,
right,
It starts to melt, and that's exactly what happens.
Okay, and describe what that means, what the meltdown means.
What it means is that the fuel starts to melt so that the cladding, the reactor cores are filled with these fuel assemblies that have, they're like uranium pellets, basically,
right,
that have been highly enriched to make the fuel. And they're lined with zirconium. And if they're not cooled, then they start reacting, and the zirconium actually melts. So then it's all exposed, and they can start, you know, reacting and go into uncontrolled chain reactions, which is what happened. But instead of an explosion, most of the radioactivity, or a lot of it anyway, contaminated a lot of the water, and a lot of this has leaked into the Pacific Ocean. And in fact, there was a piece that was done in the Montreal Gazette just a few days ago talking about the fact that 60 to 80% of the fish in the Pacific Ocean are now contaminated.
Because
of this accident.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the whole meltdown thing. So this chain reaction happens with the radioactive pellets, and it melts the zirconium cladding that's been protecting it from exposure. So does the chain reaction stop? I mean, have they been able to cool it down so that that reaction has stopped, or is it ongoing, or does it at some point stop itself?
Well, One thing that has been true not only about Fukushima but basically about many nuclear situations, it's been very, very difficult to get really clear and accurate information out from Japan.
Mm-hmm. Is that because you can't get into the plants, or is it because the government's trying to keep the information quiet?
Or both. Yeah. And you know, it is true that until people can get in and actually look at what's gone on, you know, nobody will know for sure what's actually happened in the plants.
Yeah.
So, but it's also true that the Japanese government has done everything that they can to allay fears, which is, it's been really crazy. In fact, there was another article in the Canadian Medical Association Journal that just really, really ripped into the Japanese government. They call the way that they've dealt with the accident, they say it was a culture of cover-up that has led to unconscionable health risks among the Japanese people.
And those health risks still exist, is that right?
Absolutely. They absolutely do. There are still aftershocks from the earthquake, and there are some questions, too, as to whether it was the tsunami that did all of the damage, that that there are indications that the earthquake itself, which, mind you, I mean, it was a 9.0 earthquake, which is enormous. I mean, certainly bigger than anything that California has experienced. I'm from California, and I was in the 1971 earthquake, and I remember what that was like.
Isn't it true, too, that some of the problem wasn't with the cores themselves, but with the cooling pools where the spent fuel rods were being kept?
Yes, that's correct. That in these designs, this is the GE Mark I boiling water reactor, and we've got 23 of those here in the United States as well. But the fuel pools are actually on top of the reactor, I think they're on top of the reactor buildings, or they're on top somewhere.
Yes,
and they're not covered by any kind of containment dome as the reactor core itself is. And there's a huge amount of intensely radioactive fuel in there. And, you know, one of the pools supposedly lost all its water. I mean, it's hard to know exactly what's going on.
So there's debris that needs to be disposed of. Is part of that debris removing the radioactive elements themselves, the pellets and the spent fuel rods that were left there? Is that part of what we're talking about?
That's not what I was talking about in my article. What I was talking about was the 20 million metric tons of debris from the tsunami. But because of the meltdowns, a lot of that is now radioactive, some of it intensely radioactive. And in fact, you know, that's another one of the problems with this technology is that once something becomes contaminated, it's just kind of out there. And what are you going to do? In fact, I saw today, just this morning, their headlines in Japan talking about how they're using contaminated material to rebuild roads and waterways and things like that. You know, I mean, it's just a huge mess. And when I was doing the research for this article, it was really shocking to read of all of these piles of debris. I mean, imagine 20 million metric tons of this stuff.
Yeah.
And part of the issue that they have, and I mean, my heart really, really, really goes out to them because on one hand, you know, here they are and this unbelievable disaster has occurred and they've got these piles of wreckage. Stinking wreckage all over, you know, their coastal regions up there in the contaminated areas. And a lot of people have been complaining that we have to move forward. We have to do something about this. We have to, you know, clean it up. But because it's contaminated and because there's so much of it, it's like, how do they deal with it?
Well, isn't it true? I'm going to take a break here, but isn't it true that one of the things the government's looking into doing is the incineration of this waste?
Yes, they are doing that.
And what happens when the waste is incinerated if it's radioactive? Does that eliminate the radioactivity?
Absolutely not. It just sends it up into the air.
Turns it into smoke and ash.
Yes. smoke and ash, and where it can do much more damage in terms of how much farther it can travel.
Okay, hang on with me, Karen. I'm going to take a little break here. We'll come back and continue our discussion. 808-0810 is the telephone number. That's 8080-810. I'm speaking with Karen Chapman. She's an independent investigative environmental journalist. Her most recent piece, you can read this on whowhatwhy.com, whowhatwhy.com, a terrific website, and it's called Fukushima Update, Why We Should Still Be Worried. I'm Pat Thurston. You're listening to KGO.
It's the biggest game of the season.
We're speaking with Karen Charman, and my apologies, Karen, for messing up your name. I actually wrote it down as Chapman, but, and I don't know why, because that's nowhere in any of my notes. So I apologize for that right from the get-go. But we're talking about Fukushima and what happened there and the dangers that still exist there. And I'm wondering if you can kind of give us a little crash course in radiation exposure. You know, we all know that background radiation exists everywhere, that our own bodies emit radiation. So tell us a little bit about the difference in radiation exposure when it becomes hazardous and the kind of radiation we're talking about in Japan right now.
Well, the problem with radiation is that, first of all, yes, it is true, we are all exposed to background radiation. And that's something that a lot of nuclear proponents like to say in order to try to allay people's fears about it. But there, first of all, there are certain amounts of background radiation that we're exposed to, but then with nuclear power and the weapons testing that happened in the 40s, 50s, up until the early 60s, that increased the level of background information. There's also nuclear power plants that routinely emit radioactivity as part of their normal operations. And then once things are contaminated, I mean, a lot of these elements, they're very, very, very long-lived. And there are many different radioactive elements. So it's not just one thing that's radiation. And, for example, cesium-137, which is a byproduct of the nuclear fission process, that's one of the contaminants that they're really worried about with Fukushima, and they're measuring high levels of it. It doesn't just disappear. It goes up into the air. It comes down as rainfall. It gets into the soil. It then gets into plants that, that say cattle or, you know, other animals will eat. And as it goes from place to place, it bioaccumulates, which means it concentrates as it moves up that food chain. And when you take an element, a radioactive element into your body, through either ingesting food, drinking contaminated water, or even breathing contaminated air, that's different than standing next to something that's radioactive, that's kind of, you know, that you're getting exposed to that way.
Right.
And when it's in your body, depending upon the element, because a lot of these elements, they'll mimic other other chemicals, like strontium is similar to calcium. So it will go in your body where calcium goes, which is into the bones and your teeth. Radioactive iodine, for example, that will go to your thyroid. You know, and that's one of the reasons that,
they will... In Japan, are all of these different kinds of radiation, are all of those things present as a result of the Fukushima accident?
Yes.
Okay. And what's happening to the people there? I mean, is there any way to quantify the damage that the exposure has produced to the people in Japan?
I think at this stage, probably not. It's also true, and this is kind of typical of these situations. I've also looked at Three Mile Island in depth. In fact, we should talk about some of the parallels between, you know, how that accident was handled and how this one's being handled. Citizens often have to take it into their own hands to go and collect data themselves, because there is the nuclear industry is so unbelievably privileged that the government's knee-jerk response is to downplay, to dismiss.
Right. And I would think in some part, so are the people. I mean, I'm sure that in Japan, the people want as much as possible to get back to normal lives, to kind of put their lives back on a normal track as soon as they possibly can. Maybe that's hindering them in dealing with the reality that surrounds them.
I don't know about that. I think that Japan, you know, we hear, I haven't been to Japan myself, but we certainly hear that culturally they tend to be much more into consensus and cooperation and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But since this accident, there's been an absolute upwelling of resistance against nuclear power and an outrage among the population mm-hmm. there. Because they understand that their government failed them and continues to fail them.
Right. Yeah, and look at how they've been victimized, you know, in their history. And this
right.
is one that they can claim that they did to themselves, which has got to be very difficult to deal with as well. Do we know about exports, that, you know, the things that are being produced in Japan? Is there resistance to countries that are taking in Japanese-produced products, like cars and things like that? Should we have some concern about whether it's contaminated?
Well, personally, I would. I know that not nearly enough monitoring is being done, for example, of the food.
Mm.
And, in fact, I read recently that, actually, this was in Gail Green's piece, that the Japanese government is actually encouraging people to buy food from the Fukushima areas.
At what point are we going to know what happened to these people? Is it just that all of a sudden everybody in the region is going to have cancer, that their life expectancy is going to be substantially diminished, that there are going to be increased birth defects? What's going to show us what damage has been wrought by this?
I think we should expect to see that. You know, the government there has raised the exposure limits to, even for children, 20 times the international level of, you know, what's acceptable. And I think that, you know, we will see a much bigger increase in cancer. The only problem, though, and this is something that happened with Chernobyl and is still being argued about, despite the dramatic effects of that accident, in Belarus, they were actually talking about it as a demographic doomsday. But in 2005, the World Health Organization did a report on the health effects of Chernobyl, and they said in that report that only 50 people had died as a direct result of the accident at Chernobyl, and they expected only 4,000 people ultimately to die from that accident. But they didn't include so much information, and 2 years ago, another study came out that was published by the New York Academy of Sciences that mm-hmm. was actually compiled by the researchers on the ground in Chernobyl, and they said that nearly 1 million people have died mm-hmm. from Chernobyl. But the problem is that the nuclear, the nuclear industry, the whole nuclear establishment, it's so privileged that the officials, they don't want to know. They certainly don't want to acknowledge this information.
Yeah, Karen, we're just about out of time here. Can you tell us if we're in danger here in California from the debris? I mean, we know that it's begun washing ashore.
I'm not sure how radioactive the debris is. I honestly don't know. I think the bigger concern, though, is about the incineration that's going on in Japan, because that is just going to spread the radioactivity much farther, including to this country, because the radionuclides go up into the jet stream and they're carried all over the place.
Mm. Well, Karen, we are out of time, but I do want to refer people to your article where they can read this. Thank you for being with us. Karen Charman is her name. She's an independent investigative environmental journalist. And again, you can read her article and a lot of other articles on whowhatwhy.com. It's a remarkable website. It's a website that prides itself on investigative journalism. And they really are fearless. I mean, you will see things there that will